your life.
I don't cite all your wonderful achievements. It'd take too long. You can just sit in the seat, one of these empty seats. Good afternoon and a very warm welcome to the Oxford Martin School. I'm Ian Golden, the director of the school, and it's an enormous pleasure today to welcome Professor Joe Stiglitz. If I was to give him a full introduction, it would take far too long, but let me just highlight a few of his extraordinary achievements. Nobel Prize winner, not only for his work on asymmetric information, but really in recognition of the fact that he has probably done more to contribute to the growth of economic understanding in the world than virtually anyone that one can think about, certainly alive today. In monetary policy, in macro policy, in development economics, in rural economics, industrial economics, labor economics, and many other areas. He's also been someone who has nurtured an interdisciplinary view of society and economics. He was the founder of the Journal of Economic Perspectives and has been enormously influential in making people understand how economics fits in with politics and society across the world, not only in his native US, but in many other places. As chief economist of the World Bank, he was fundamentally central to the reshaping of the economic policies of the World Bank coming out of a period of structural adjustment and bad experiences in the 1990s and before. As the head of the Council of Economic Advisers under Bill Clinton, he was fundamentally significant in shaping the economic policies of that time. And when people look back on those Clinton years, many people see it as the heyday of economic policy in the US, not least because of the role that Joe was able to play in this. We are delighted in the Oxford Martin School that he's also helped us shape our size and future. He's on the advisory council of the Oxford Martin School, has been a wonderful friend to us in many times. And this all while writing books at an extraordinary rate. Many of you will know, I think it's your most recent book, The Price of Inequality, is it? The Price of Inequality, which if you haven't read, I commend to all of you. It really explains why inequality matters and why it's so corrosive to all of our societies and to our futures. And he'll be talking a little bit about that today, but also tomorrow. For those of you that couldn't get in here and then in the overflows, or if you want to hear Joe again tomorrow, he's giving the Fulbright lecture tomorrow at 5 p.m. at Pembroke. But his other books on the trillion-dollar war, on globalization, and on many, many other areas, if I was to read them all, again, I would spend too long. But I commend you to the websites, Amazon and other places that have them. Every book that Joe has written has been totally original and worth reading. Books not only of their time, but still which remain extremely relevant even 10, 20 years after they've written. So it's with enormous pleasure that I welcome Joe to the stage and thank him for coming here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be back here in Oxford. The subject is maybe not that pleasant of a subject because it is the story of both the failure of economic theory, economic practice, and of our economies. It's been more than a half decade since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, but it's actually been 6-7 years since the breaking of the real estate bubble in the United States that brought on the economic downturn. Economic downturn was to a large extent caused by a bubble. The reigning paradigm that guided the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, and many other central bankers said that bubbles didn't exist, even as it was very clear that one was being formed. They went on to say, even if it did exist, even if there was a possibility, you couldn't tell it until after it broke. But of course, economic policy is always made with uncertainty. You never know for sure. You know, when they fight inflation, they're never sure that there's going to be worse inflation going forward. So, to a large extent, these were all excuses to defend a particular ideology, an ideology which said that markets on their own were efficient and stable, that government, central banks, should have a minimal role. The minimal role was to make sure that there was not inflation of higher than like 2%, that if you managed to maintain inflation low and stable at a level 2% or below, it was necessary and almost sufficient to ensure growth and stability. And those ideas were extraordinarily powerful, not really supported by what I would call good economic theory, that is to say, the kind of economic theory that I did, but it was supported by the dominant paradigm in macroeconomics, what is called DSGE models. There was really important work that had been done criticizing that school. A lot of work had been done on issues, even of bubbles, of credit interlinkages, of instabilities, including by some people here. But most of that work was not integrated into the mainstream. And what I'm going to talk about today is not the flaws in the economic models that led up to the crisis, but I really want to talk about where we are today and why it is that there has not been a robust recovery. So there, in terms of the analysis of what you might call the analysis of deep downturns, there are three basic questions. What causes the downturn? What are the perturbations to the economy? And the standard paradigm in economics that prevailed was that it was exogenous shocks, unexplained, things like technology, not what actually happened, which was an endogenous shock. It was a bubble that we created, or that we allowed to be created, that the central banks turned their turned away from. The second question of basic of deep downturns is amplification. Good economic systems take shocks and dampen them. You know, like a car has shock absorbers. You design a car so that when you go over a bump, it doesn't fall apart and that absorbs the shock. And there are some shock absorbers in the economy. But there are also aspects of the economy that have become amplifiers that take a perturbation or disturbance and actually make them worse. And unfortunately, most of the models that were prevailing believed that we had built in really, really good shock absorbers rather than really, really good amplifiers. So just to give you one example of that, one of the big shock absorbers that they believed they had developed was diversification. You take risk, you spread them around the world, and that meant that if anything happened, the system, because the risk were dispersed, was able to absorb them. Now, I sometimes say, to try to explain why that might not always be a good idea, think about a group of 100 people coming down with a contagious disease and arriving in New York, say with smallpox. I don't think anybody would say the appropriate response was to take each 100 of those people, send 2 of them to each of our states to diversify the risk. But that was what the IMF suggested and the US Treasury suggested was had protected us totally. We had taken these risks, spread them all over the world, and that the economic system was as a result, more stable. Now, you might say, some of you who are not economists say, how could they actually believe that? But they didn't think that way, although they were used words after the crisis. They used words like contagion. So they were very aware that there was something about economic interconnectivity that was like a contagious disease. They were using that metaphor. But in their analysis before the crisis, they never put together this notion of buffers, diversification, spreading risks in the good sense, and the second sense of taking the disease and spreading the disease around the world. That they never, and they still haven't, begun to understand what is the mathematics, what is the underlying structures that lead it to working some cases and not to others. And actually, some important work has now been done to try to differentiate those circumstances in which it is a good thing to diversify, in some cases, in other cases, it's a bad thing. Some of my own work and some work with colleagues, we've actually tried to analyze the optimal structure of these organizations, optimal degree of diversification. And a general theorem, before the presumption had been it was always optimal to maximize diversification. The more diversified, the better. We now know that that's not true in general. The third question of deep downturns is, why do they persist? Standard economic theory, again, says that whatever the shock, the economic system, competitive equilibrium, there's a full employment equilibrium. It's even true regardless of what the level of leverage is. All the leverage, debt, is some people owe money to others. It isn't like you've lost assets. Leverage is simply one group of people in a society owing money to others. And there is nothing in general competitive equilibrium theory that says that the existence of large leverage should lead to persistence of high levels of unemployment. And yet at the practical level, this has become standard wisdom. So we have a very big disparity between what most people, at least the policymakers, take as received wisdom, and what the competitive equilibrium analysis that most of you have had to suffer with as students. So what I want to do is, I'm not going to answer fully the third question, but what I want to spend my time this noon talking about is where we are and try to explain why the recovery from this downturn has been so slow. Why it is that we are not back quickly to full employment, which a lot of the standard models suggested would be the case. So we are in the deepest downturn clearly since the Great Depression. And I think we should be clear that in terms of I call it the North Atlantic malaise. Sometimes it's called the global economic crisis, but my friends in Australia remind me that it's only in the North that it exists, that it was not in Brazil, it wasn't in Australia. So I wanted to correct, it's not a global economic crisis, it's the North Atlantic crisis. Here we are in the North Atlantic, and it is the deepest downturn, and it's the longest, with the end not yet in sight. This is a really important point because there are a lot of people who are expressing a sigh of relief that the European recession has come to an end. And they're making a very big confusion between the end of a recession, that you're not falling off a cliff, and a strong, robust recovery. Those are two totally different things. And so it is a good thing that you aren't falling off a cliff, both for you and for the rest of the world. But it's really important, and I'm going to try to give you some numbers that highlight the fact that much of Europe is still in depression. when I was chief economist of the World Bank, when Ewan was there at the time, and we had the East Asia crisis was going on, and a couple of us described what was going on in East Asia, like in Indonesia, as a depression. And we were told we weren't allowed to use that word, depression, because it was just too depressing. we had to change our vocabulary, and we would say Indonesia is having a D, and Korea was having an R, recession. But Indonesia was having a depression. It was 40% unemployment in the island of Java, the main island. So there's no way you could describe other than as a depression. When you look at many of the countries in Europe, what is going on is worse than the Great Depression, and I'll give you some statistics a little later on. But I want to begin by talking about one more remark. We don't know how long this will last, and it's important to realize that. Part of the reason we don't know how long it's going to last is how long it lasts will depend on the policies that we put in place. It's endogenous, it will depend. But in terms of the, you might call it the self-healing properties of an economic system, one way of thinking about it is to go put yourself in the position, put yourself back in the Great Depression. In the United States, the Great Depression began in 1929, at least officially, with the stock market crash. By 35, 36, the New Deal had begun to have some effects, and many Americans believed the end was in sight. And because they believed the end was in sight, they started cutting back on the New Deal. The pressure, there was in the election of 1936, there was, the view was that we're over it, better start focusing on the deficit. And there were cutbacks. And predictably, the U.S. went back into another recession. And had it not been for World War II, there is no reason to believe that we would have emerged from that long depression. We did not emerge until government spending on the war efforts began. And it was government spending, let's make it clear, it was government spending that got us out of the Great Depression. It would have been even better if the government spending was to strengthen our economy by investing in infrastructure or technology or education. It was too bad that it had to be for armaments. But nonetheless, it was government spending that got us out of the Great Depression. And that's something a message I think is really important. Well, turning to the situation in the United States, which is better than in Europe, it's still the case that growth is still anemic, barely fast enough to create enough jobs for the new entrants in the labor force. The unemployment rate has been going down, but the unemployment rate has been going down because people have stopped looking for jobs. And we have this peculiar statistical artifact. There's a whole group of people looking at statistics. We call people unemployed only if they say they are actively looking for a job. But people who have been looking for a job for 2, 3, 4 years and stop looking are not called unemployed. But of course, they're not employed. And so the official unemployment statistic for the United States is now in the low sixes, 6.3 or something like that. But if you correct for the labor force participation, I'll give you a graph in a second, what you understand is that the true unemployment rate is much, much higher than that. It's much more above 9%, which for the United States is really very, very, very high. There's something about 19, 20 million Americans who would like a full-time job and can't get it. One of the reasons that we know the labor market is so weak is we see it reflected in wages. Wages are still stagnating. 95% of the gains in income that have occurred since the so-called recovery, the administration declared recovery in 2009 because we ended the downturn. This is, where Europe just joined. And 95% of the gains since 2009 have gone to the top 1%. So if you tell most Americans that the recession is over, they laugh at you. It's not there in their pocketbook. The median income in the United States is lower than it was 25 years ago, a quarter century ago. But if you look at particular demographic groups, it's much worse. And a demographic group that I feel a certain sympathy for is males. And median income of a full-time male worker in the United States is lower than it was 40 years ago. This is adjusted for inflation. So if you want to understand some of American politics, you see some angry young men, you could understand that their prospects, they know that the likelihood that they will have an income lower than that of their parents or grandparents is very significant. So here are just some charts that reflect what I just said. The median household income is lower than it was in 1989. For a male worker, it's lower than it was in 1972. And here you have the plunging of the labor force participation rate back to the level that it was before women entered into the labor force. And this weak performance is in spite of some very strong good luck, you might say, in the United States, the discovery of large amounts of shale. We have a very strong IT sector, but the fact is that although we have some very strong points, our economy, as I said, is anemic. And one point I want to raise, because it's even more relevant for Europe, a recent study of the Fed has pointed out is that this persistent unemployment is having a significant effect in lowering estimates of our long-term potential growth. An effect called hysteresis. Young people who don't get jobs lose skills, and therefore the job potential, potential growth is lowered. Well, this is just a graph showing a trend line from 1980 through the crisis. I just want to emphasize one of the striking things about growth after 1980 in the era of deregulation is that it was much weaker than it was in the era, in the decades after World War II. We enacted all these policies of deregulation and all those supposedly to increase growth, and it lowered the growth. What it succeeded in doing is increasing inequality. I'll talk about that tomorrow. But then you see the effect of the crisis in 2008, and that our growth has been markedly below that trend. And the purple dots at the bottom describe the cumulative losses, the percentage loss from trend, now somewhat greater than 15%, and growing, a total loss far greater than the misallocation of resources before the crisis. So the financial sector really misallocated resources before the crisis. You know, no one would say that building shoddy houses in the middle of the Nevada desert was the best use of the world's scarce capital. But that's what our financial markets did. But the loss in economic resources from the disparity between potential and actual growth in the 6 years since the crisis, cumulatively is now in the trillions of dollars, far greater than the original misallocation. And that's why this question about how do you get back into recovery is really a critical question. Well, the only thing that makes U.S. feel good is that things could be worse. And when we look across the Atlantic, we see they are worse. And so, yeah, I don't know if it's Schadenfreude, but we sort of it does make us say, you know, feel good. So the basic story you know probably better than I do is GDP in most per capita in many of the countries is below the 2008 level. Spain and Greece are in depression with more than 50% youth unemployment. The impact on future potential growth of Europe is almost surely much greater than what I just described as the negative effects on U.S. potential growth. But even the most successful country, Germany, has grown at an average rate that under normal circumstances, would be given a D grade. And it's even worse when you realize that about the bottom three deciles in Germany have had negative growth. So what Europe looks to up to as the success in any other context would be viewed as a failure. And that model of success, which is based on one country having surpluses, is not one that can be a model for others. It is, you know, economists disagree about lots of things, but one thing that we do all agree about is that not every country can have a surplus. I know, you know, the sum of the surpluses have to equal the sum of the deficits. So if some country has a surplus, some other country has to have a deficit. And the German strategy is for every country to have a surplus. And somebody, you know, some of us have been trying to explain to them that there is an arithmetic problem here. And so far we have not succeeded, but I hope some of you can try and succeed. And as I said, the celebration of return to growth shows how much expectations have been lowered. So these are just, I can say, graphs that are familiar, that the high unemployment in Europe, you know, really record unemployment rates, but even dwarfed by the youth unemployment, average youth unemployment of close to 25%, but youth unemployment in Spain of over 50%, in Greece over 60%. You know, you graduate from college and the prospects of getting a job are just very, very low. It's not just people who didn't graduate from college, it's the people who do graduate from college. Families are being split. You know, go to, you know, our friends in Portugal and Spain. All the children who can are leaving to other countries. And it's just devastating, their parents, their families. And they know what will happen. They'll leave, they'll get married, and it will be a different world. So here are just some data on the what's happened to GDP per capita, where what one sees is that the only country where GDP per capita exceeds what it was in 2007, before the crisis, is Germany, and every other country is lower. Even more striking, if you look at statistics on GDP per working age population, and, you know, divide GDP, real GDP, by the working age population, there are only two countries, United States and Germany, where we're back to where we were before the crisis. Everybody else has lower GDP. So it's been already a half decade of lost growth, and the prospects are that this will continue for a long time. So it's not just like the Latin American lost decade. I think unless something is done, one could be looking for a lost quarter century. The basic problem in Europe, you know, I hate to talk about this today when you're having elections, and let me give the bottom line before I, I think what Europe needs is more Europe, a stronger Europe. But the euro, and I say the EU was a really good idea. I think this kind of integration was really, I don't want to interfere with your politics, but I will say what I. They made one minor mistake, the euro. And UK made a good decision, I think, not to join the euro. But having created the euro, ending it, there are reimbursements, the cost of ending it is very significant. And I think they probably could make the euro work, but in order to make it work, they will have to strengthen Europe. And so there are two possible directions, even more Europe or less Europe. And of those, I think the right one is more Europe. And the fundamental problem is there is a structure of the Eurozone. So when you talk about structural reform, what's important is not the structural reforms in the individual countries. Of course, every country always has to go through structural reforms. But the real problem is the structure of the Eurozone itself. And that's what has to require change. And the problems of the Eurozone have been compounded by flawed policies that have been partly a result of some of the main, some of the same mindset. So let me just very quickly go through this. I'm running behind. They recognized, it was a political project, and they recognized that Europe was not an optimal currency area, a set of countries that could work, that would naturally share a common currency. My colleague, Bob Mundell, wrote a very famous paper in the 60s called Optimal Currency Area, defining what are the conditions. He got a Nobel Prize for it because he was given credit as being the intellectual godfather for Europe. Some people are suggesting they should take away the Nobel Prize because it was a disaster. But I think the real answer is that more integration is, say, not less. And he did highlight what were the conditions that were needed and what needed to be done. And Europe, unfortunately, it was enough of a political momentum to get the euro going, but not enough political momentum to do what would be needed to make it work. So part of the analysis that the countries were very diverse, they said we have to converge. And the convergence criteria that they thought of as all that you needed for convergence was low debt and deficit to GDP ratio. But it should be clear, I mean, it was clear before that that's might be necessary, but clearly wasn't sufficient. Spain, Ireland had surpluses and low debt GDP ratios before the crisis. So the crisis caused the deficits. And yet, again, Germany doesn't seem to understand that what was a flawed analysis before the crisis continues to be a flawed analysis after the crisis. So focusing on deficits and debts, they are pushing for a policy prescription that is exacerbating the problems. They failed to put in place the institutions that would have helped Europe adjust to differential shocks to different parts of the system. They took away two of the critical adjustment mechanisms, exchange rates and interest rate, and they didn't put anything into place. And there was another flaw, very deep, that was, I think, not widely recognized. They led to the problem of countries borrowing in a foreign currency. And so they created the problem that those of us at the World Bank have seen all the time. If you have a country that borrows in dollars, you can create a foreign exchange currency crisis. So why is it that the United States is never going to have a sovereign debt crisis? I think, I mean, maybe I'm talking too soon, but the reason is we will always pay the debts because what we say, if you buy a U.S. bond, what does it say? We promise to pay, you know, $1,000. How do I know we'll always be able to print it? Always pay it? Because we control the printing press. We will give you pieces of paper that say $1,000. They may not be worth very much, but we will fulfill our debt obligations. But in fact, the market does not perceive any risk of significant inflation going forward. So, but this is not the situation that Greece was in. It owed money in euros, but it couldn't control the printing press. So this kind of a problem of a country borrowing a currency that it didn't control had never been a problem in Europe, and the euro made it a problem. So underlying these failures was this a kind of ideology that I referred to in the beginning of my talk, which is reflected in a whole set of institutional provisions. For instance, a prescription against industrial policies. Industrial policies that I believe are very important for the countries that are at the bottom to catch up to the top. a central bank that has to focus on, that says you're supposed to focus on exclusively on inflation, as if that's the only macroeconomic problem. U.S. focuses on unemployment, growth, inflation, and now financial stability. And it's particularly problematic is other central banks are worrying about unemployment, lowering their interest rates, and you're focusing on inflation. Those interest rate differentials make increase the value of the euro and make Europe even less competitive. Another example is that they created a dynamically unstable system. And I think this is, in a way, one of the most interesting aspects of it. They created a system that they didn't intend to do this. They wanted to make it more stable, but they created, in many ways, a system that was dynamically unstable. Let me explain a couple examples. A single market allows money to move anywhere in Europe. And that was thought a great idea because it leads to greater efficiency of the allocation of capital. But what they didn't realize is that the way markets work are not, they don't exist in the abstract, in a vacuum, that behind markets are governments. So let me give you an example of what I have in mind. 2008, the global financial crisis, largely caused by mismanagement of risk by US banks. What happens after the crisis? Where did money go? To the United States. Was it because our banks had shown that they were marvelous at managing risk? No, they had shown that they were dismal in managing risk. Why did they go to the United States? Why was money flowing rapidly to the United States? Because the United States government had said, here's a check for $700 billion, but by the way, if you need a few more trillion dollars, don't worry, we have it. And we have no concern, you know, we don't worry about equity, fairness, or anything like that. We are going to save our banking system. And it was bipartisan, Bush, Obama, basically said, here's a blank check. And with that kind of confidence and a strength of the American economy, money moved to the United States. Well, in Europe, the same kind of situation. Who would keep their money in the Spanish banking system if you could move your money to Germany, someplace else where the German government will back the banks? And if you look at the correlation between CDS spreads of banks and sovereigns, they're very highly correlated. The result is that it was money moving out. What you see is not a surprise. The countries that were in crisis had massive declines in availability of credit. So I see you're looking at my clock. Okay, so let me go. I haven't even come to the main point of the talk yet. So the main point of the talk is so the policies of the flawed structure have been combined with the policies of flawed policies of austerity. You all know about that. It hasn't worked. The fact is that it was supposed to increase exports, didn't work. Exports have been relatively unaffected. Current account balances were improved, but the main reason the current account balances are improved is that you starve people and they stop buying importing goods. So the result of all this is a growing gap between trend growth and what would have prevailed in the absence of the euro crisis that is even much larger than in the United States. And what is needed is pretty clear, as I said, more a stronger Europe with a banking union, some forms of mutualization of debt, revision of the ECB mandate, a growth strategy. What I want to spend just a minute on is explaining the lackluster recovery. It's mainly a lack of aggregate demand, global aggregate demand. And the reason for the lack of aggregate demand are global imbalances. There's a basic asymmetry that countries that have a surplus don't have to increase their spending, and the countries with a deficit may have to reduce their spending. And that asymmetry of response, it leads to a deficiency of an aggregate demand. This was a point that Keynes talked about at the time of the Great Depression. And he wanted to impose a tax on countries with surpluses. We've had a lot of discussions of the problems of surpluses. The United States has been very vocal about Chinese surpluses. We've had a lot of discussion of global imbalances. Most of it, though, before the crisis, was focused on a disorderly unwinding of these imbalances, not on the consequences for global aggregate demand. The United States, before the crisis, or even after the crisis, was very critical of the surpluses of China, but Northern European surpluses, both as a percentage of GDP and absolutely, are now larger than that of China. So if you want to, a source of a deficiency in aggregate demand, that's a very big source. Second major source of this deficiency of aggregate demand is growing inequality in most countries around the world. And it's very much the same. Those at the top who get more income don't have to spend it. The people at the bottom who have less income have to constrain their spending. Now, in the United States, we found a way out of the problem for a while. The Fed was very ingenious and said, the way we can deal with the problem of the poor people having no money that I described before and keep up our spending was very easy. Let's create a bubble and deregulate, keep interest rates low, forget about, just create a bubble. Everybody will feel rich and they'll forget how poor they are. And it worked, but it was very short-sighted. The bottom 80% of Americans were consuming 110% of their income. And as I said, you don't have to have a PhD to know that that's not sustainable. As the one of the predecessors, my predecessor as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors once said, that which is not sustainable won't be sustained. And this wasn't sustained. We're now, the Fed is trying to replicate that strategy. Can't create right away another housing bubble, but it's trying to create a stock market bubble with some success. But the fact is that focusing on getting consumption going, but not very successful in getting investment growing. So growing inequality is a major source of weaknesses in global aggregate demand. And I think it's going to be hard to get back to a robust recovery with this high level of inequality. But the crisis has made the problem of global imbalances worse. The third aspect of that is leading to and related to the growing inequality is the structural transformation. The Northern European, the North Atlantic, Europe and America, are going through a process of structural transformation, a little bit analogous to what happened 100 years ago. 100 years ago, 120 years ago, most people worked in agriculture. And then we were the victims of our success. Agricultural productivity increased, and so we needed fewer and fewer people to produce the food that we need. So today, in the United States, like 2 to 3% of the population are produce more food than even an obese society can consume. So what does that mean? That means that people have to go from agriculture to someplace else. And where do they go? They went to manufacturing. Well, we're in a similar situation, except it's a little bit more complicated. We've had huge increases in productivity in manufacturing, greater than the increase in demand, and therefore global employment in manufacturing is actually going down. But now the problem is compounded because of changing of globalization, changing comparative advantage, and we're getting, Europe and America are getting a smaller share of that diminishing global employment in manufacturing. And that means we have to move to other sectors, service sector. But the nature of these restructurings is markets don't do very well on their own. Very understandable, because when you have this kind of structural transformation, people with the old, whose invested in the old economy, whatever that was, their capital becomes worth less. So your human capital goes down in value. If you're located in the wrong cities, you know, if you happen to buy a home in Detroit, you can buy a very nice mansion for about $10,000 in Detroit. Not sure why anybody would want to move there, but so people who are in these areas and in these industries have their capital diminish, and they can't therefore make the investments to move to the new sectors, and that means the economy doesn't do the restructuring. And of course, that compounds, adds to the problem of inequality. The fourth important problem is that we have a dysfunctional financial system. If you have surpluses, you could still get demand by recycling those funds to productive uses. Let me put it in slightly differently. Right now, if you look around the world, we have huge pools of money, savings, but we also have huge demands, huge needs. Let me say not demands, huge needs. Climate change, people here were very worried about climate change. It's a real problem. Retrofitting the global economy for climate change is going to take huge amounts of investment. Anybody who works in development knows how much investment and infrastructure is needed. Anybody who visits New York knows that we need infrastructure. We have crumbling bridges, airports. You can't even get it's a third world airport system. Anyway, the point is, it's not as if there is not, there are real needs, but our financial system is not able to take these pool of funds and bring them to the places where the social needs. Instead of that, they took all the funds and invested them in shoddy houses in the middle of the Nevada desert. Now, the only good part is that they're so shoddy that they're falling apart, so that we'll be able to restart our real estate industry faster than if we had good construction. But this is clearly not the best use of scarce global savings. So, some of us have been working on trying to think about how to get a more functional financial system. And a lot of the debate, so interesting to me, a lot of the debate about financial sector regulation and financial sector reform has focused on the issue is how do we make sure the financial system doesn't destroy the rest of the economy? How make sure that it's stable? But very little discussion is on how do we be sure the financial system does what it's supposed to do. That is to say, it's all about how do we prevent it from hurting us, not how we can make sure that it actually helps us. And that, I think, should be more of the focus of the concern. Well, I don't have time to go through all this. We can... out of all this, the basic line is what the world needs is more fiscal stimulus. And I'm not worried about borrowing. The U.S. particularly can borrow at negative real interest rates, and we have a large reservoir of investment needs, high returns that we can, would strengthen our country's balance sheet if we measured it correctly. So, what I think is the world needs a fiscal stimulus, but even if you were myopic and only focused on the liability side, on the deficits, one can design a balanced budget multiplier, increasing taxes on the top, even which would increase the efficiency of the economy, because it would eliminating the special provisions for capital gains taxation and dividend taxation in the United States would, over the next 10 years, raise over $2 trillion. And if we use that money to stimulate our economy, it would have substantial effects on growth both now and in the future. Unfortunately, politics in Europe and America make that unlikely. Monetary policy is the only game in town, but it's not likely to help. And The result of this is that my outlook is that we're in for a hard ride. The prospects remain dismal, and we know what needs to be done to get the economies back on track. We need not just the monetary policy, which is, as I say, limited, but we need fiscal policy, and we need structural reform. But for Europe, it's the structure of the Eurozone. But the prospects of the political support anytime soon for such policy remains bleak, and the likely outcome is a strong prospects of a long-term Japanese-style malaise. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much, Joe, for what could have been a much longer lecture, but thanks for those insights. I think we all are extremely concerned with where we are and how we get out of where we are. So that's absolutely at the center of our minds, not least today, when we should be voting for the European parliamentary elections and the outcomes there. So we've got about just under half an hour for discussion and questions and answers. If you're in an overflow room, you'll need to come in here because we only will be able to do that in here. This is being webcast and videoed. So if you don't want to be on webcast or video, I suggest you stay silent. but who'd like to go first? Yep. Gentleman over here. Wait, just wait for the mic.
I formed a campaign for universal inheritance in 1997, a basic inheritance for all financed by a reform of inheritance taxes. Do you agree that thinkers and policymakers are neglecting the structure of inheritance of capital?
I think the issue of inheritance is absolutely critical. And I think it's been brought out particularly forcefully by Piketty's new book that raises the prospect even more that we will be winding up in an inherited plutocracy. If you look at the list of the Forbes 100, you see at the very top large numbers of people who inherited their wealth. Inheritance tax only affects the people mostly at the very top. But the more general issue that I think needs to be talked about is economic opportunity. And the United States, we like to think of ourselves as the land of opportunity, the American dream, and the data that has come out over recent years has pointed out that America is among the advanced countries, among the worst in terms of economic opportunity. That is to say, the life prospects of a young American are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than almost any other country. I think most people think it's going to be getting worse. So this is not just inherited capital in the financial capital sense. A lot of this is, you might say, privileged access to human capital. And where, you know, I teach at Columbia, we have a needs-blind mission. Anybody who gets admitted gets all the financial aid they want. All the selective colleges try very hard to recruit, and yet only about 9% of the students come from the bottom half of the population. And that's because the public education system, K through 12, is sufficiently poor and very local in nature. And the United States is becoming more economically segregated. We have data to show that. So that, in fact, that means if you live in a poor area, you're likely not to get a good elementary and secondary education. And the result of that is, even if the universities are open, you can't get it. And this is even true of the state universities that have lower tuition,
and C is their mission open, the percentage of students from the bottom half of the population is very, very low across the United States, very much lower than at the top. Only one state university has been able to succeed in getting a profile that is representative of the demography of that state. And you know, the facts are that in terms of education, which is, as I say, I'm emphasizing this because it's not just physical financial capital, it's also human capital that's important. Somebody from a rich family who does poorly in school has better life prospects than somebody from a poor family who does well in school. So these are, you know, is what has happened in our so-called, you know, in our democratic societies.
David?
Yes, there's one aspect of your talk I think you're a little bit pessimistic, and that is how quickly labor can be readjusted. The UK spent the whole of the interwar period in a deep depression, I mean, much larger than the US throughout 15 to 17% unemployment. When the Second World War came along, I completely agree it was the expenditure, but the difference between that and the First World War was a huge amount of training that women got taking over the men's jobs, and the men got because of the technology used in the war. And at the end of the war, Britain's growth rate basically doubled and has stayed at that much higher rate ever since, despite the fact that you would count the enormous waste of young people, particularly in the interwar period. It was very quickly resolved, Joe. So I agree that we don't need a war to get out of what we're doing, we just need the expenditure. But I do think the extra training can compensate hugely, even for 20 years of lost labor.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think that's an important note, that we need active labor market policies to help restructure. And what concerns me, I said, you know, the sectors that they're more likely to move into are the service sectors. And what are the two key service sectors that most people want? Education and health. There are very good reasons why education and health are sectors in which the government is going to play a very important role. And what are the governments doing in the United States and UK? They're actually withdrawing from those sectors. So just when you need more demand in those sectors as the place for people to go away from manufacturing, we're withdrawing. So that's another reason for my pessimism, but pessimism for what's likely to happen, not what could happen.
Tim? Tim Lump runs our climate change group, modeling group.
Yeah, so I'm not an economics person, and my question is asked out of ignorance and naivety, and it's a general question and a slightly specific one that follows from that. So I agree, I mean, everybody, I guess, agrees that these bubbles that grow and burst are bad things in the years when they happen. But how would you respond to somebody that says that if you take over the long period, if these are necessary features of an economy that is sustained over a long period, maybe the integral is beneficial. So, you know, there may well be negative bits, but if we integrate. Now, the specific question that came out of that, because I when you showed the statistic about the median male and how his income hadn't grown, my initial reaction was, well, that disproves that. But then I was thinking, well, if I had the same adjusted for real term income, say my father, maybe I wouldn't feel too bad about that. So then I was thinking, well, what has happened to the lower, say, quartile of the distribution? Because that seems to me the really important statistic to know. I mean, have they improved in the long term despite these bubbles and burst bubbles?
Well, the long term, it depends on long term, you mean. The very long term, yes, we're much better off than we were before 1800. So we can be pleased that we were born now than 250 years ago. But when I describe what happened to the median, that's much better than what's happened to the bottom quartile. Most of the people at the bottom are not college graduates. If you ask what happened to the group, say the people who've just graduated from high school, don't have any college education, over the last even 20 years, their income adjusted for inflation is down about 20%.
So things have really been bad for those students. And this is a becoming a very big policy issue. I was just on a conference call yesterday about one important issue in the U.S. policy, which is student financing student loans, students' access to colleges. With median income going down and people at the bottom going down and tuition going up, the only way that American students can afford is to getting an education is borrowing. And they're caught between a rock and a hard place because they know if they don't get a college education, wages are plummeting. As I say, 20% below what they were 20 years ago. But if they do go to college, the only way they can afford to go to college is to take on these massive debts, which can't even be discharged in bankruptcy. You know, if you borrow to buy a yacht in the United States and you overborrow, you can discharge the debt. If you borrow to go to school, you cannot discharge the debt, no matter what happens to you. So students know this, and it's become a major political issue with debt over $1.2 trillion, student debt, larger than credit card debt. And you know, there are basically two ways to go. Either you go the way that Scotland is going, which is making access, making education free, basically, or very low cost, you make income contingent loans like Australia. But I think the way the student loan programs in the United States and other countries are a way to really perpetuate inequality.
Okay, the lady over here, gentleman there.
Thank you, that was very interesting indeed. Sorry, didn't have time to go through all of it, it'd be lovely to hear it. Those of us who live in the lower deciles, that's me, consider that we're living in a kind of topsy-turvy world, some sort of Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass world upside down. And it's this business of politics. I mean, nobody dares to suggest what's really necessary, and Piketty has told us to tax the people with 2 million and those top 1% in order to get hold of these funds for investment, because they're still so scared of those useless markets who obviously don't know what they're doing, but they're so afraid that, you know, the markets will run away and they wouldn't be able to borrow any money if they tried to tax people, they'd run away somewhere else. So what on earth can we do to get rid of this myths? I mean, we're told inflation is low, employment is increasing. These are just stories, and we're going to have 2.2% growth. What can we do to make the people realize that they've got to protest against this kind of world?
Well, I think that there is increasing awareness that there is a long-term problem, that we've created an economic system that in some fundamental sense isn't working. And this is a little bit of a side point, but a little bit advertising for some of the other work that I've been involved in, which is politicians talk about GDP all the time, what's happening to national income. And I hope one of the messages that's coming across is that GDP is not necessarily a good measure of economic performance. That it doesn't measure sustainability, anybody concerned about climate change, what's doing, you know, what's happening to the environment, but it doesn't say who's getting that money. And if an economic system is not delivering for a majority of the citizens, that they see their income stagnating or going down, that's a failed economic system. And our economic system, in some sense, may have worked for long periods of time, but it evolves, and where we've evolved to is an economic system that isn't working for most citizens. Then the question becomes why? And what are the changes in the economic system? The dismal reality, you know, what people realize, you know, people had hoped that there was another economic system like state ownership that was going to solve the problem, and they've learned that that is not the answer. So we're in a different position that, than people were, say, 75, 100 years ago, where they thought they had an easy answer, you know, just to have state ownership. We know that that's not an answer. So trying to figure out what kind of a system will work is more complicated. And in my books, I try to explain the answer.
And on the GDP point, also the Sarkozy Commission that you were on discussed this at some length, and that's also on the web. Okay, the gentleman there, then, I'm going to ask you a few questions, very short, and I'll collect a few, so hopefully we'll get time to get through them all.
Thank you, Professor Stiglitz. I wholeheartedly welcome your remark on the importance of investment into research, education, and healthcare, which is a subject largely dealt with in my previously published book, Ecological Economics, Sustainability in Practice. I would like to ask you a challenging question. I have been recently looking at macro sustainability and statistics, including the World Bank website, looking for the figure debt to GDP for many countries. I found that, surprisingly, in the case of a whole host of countries, including the US, this figure is not shown. And it is shown for some African countries, for instance. Why would it be so? Thank you.
Yeah, I can't answer the question of why they don't show it. But what I would go on to point out is how difficult it is to interpret those numbers. So, and one has to be very careful. For instance, and why cross-country comparisons are also very difficult. A lot of the debt right now owed the U.S. government is held by the Federal Reserve. Now, what does that mean? The Federal Reserve is part of the U.S. government, so the U.S. government owes money to the U.S. government. Now, how do you think about that? Same thing. So we have numbers on net, gross, but in my mind, focusing on debt GDP ratio is focusing on the wrong thing. For any firm, you would look at the balance sheet, the assets and the liabilities. And one of the difficult questions is, in looking at the national balance sheet, how do you think about, you have the government liabilities, but what we also know is that if you have financial sector liabilities, they can quickly move into the government. That they go across borders. Some of these liabilities move. You know, when Ireland had its crisis, before the crisis, the debt GDP ratio was like 30%. But the banking sector liabilities were huge. And what happened in the crisis? The ECB forced, in effect, those liabilities to migrate from the banking sector into the government. I think what we now recognize is that it's important to understand the balance sheet of the public sector, but it's also one needs to look at the balance sheet of other parts of the economy, recognizing that things can migrate from one place to another more rapidly than one would have thought.
One of the reasons that that Joe is here is because we have a meeting this afternoon and this evening on statistics and data coming out of the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations, and I see a number of people that will be participating in that here. So we will chew on these issues this afternoon. All right, I'm going to try and get through those that want to ask questions in a short time. Yeah.
Professor Stiglitz, you were mentioning that when the euro was actually launched with 1% of GDP budget behind it, it was at a time when economic thinking and policy making was captured by neoliberal ideology. Actually, a little bit earlier in 1980, when Roy Jenkins, president of the European Commission at that time, later chancellor of this university, was enthusiastically preparing the European Monetary Union to propose it, he was saying that it would require only, and I emphasize the only, 5 to 7% of GDP to make it successful. And he was saying this in an optimistic sense. You mentioned the more Europe, what do you think pragmatically can be done? You mentioned convergence and industrial policy to make it a success.
Yeah, so if I had time, let me just go through what I wanted to say on that.
the screen's off.
Oh, the green. Okay, so there are a whole set of reforms. Industrial policy is really important because I think you need something to help the countries that are below catch up. Interesting, at the time, industrial policy was very much of a no-no. And the World Bank, IMF discouraged countries from doing industrial policies. The countries that became successful in East Asia all did industrial policies. And now the World Bank has changed its position. The last chief economist, Justin Lin, his main agenda for his 4 years that as head of the chief economist of the World Bank was promoting industrial policies. So there's been a real big think. But unfortunately, a lot of these mindsets are incorporated in the constitution, in effect, in the treaties of the EU that make industrial policy more difficult. The second thing, there's no magic formula for what percentage you need, whether it's 5% or, but it's clearly more than you have now. One of the things that I think, and it depends on how you do it, Eurobonds would be one way of getting more fiscal federalism, more fiscal integration. And the point is, Europe's overall debt GDP ratio is comparable to that of the United States. US can borrow at, negative real interest rate. If the European countries could borrow together at that rate, that would give so much more fiscal space for stimulative fiscal policies that would help the economies grow. So it depends on the institutional arrangements, but Eurobonds would be a good thing. I think they need, US, two-thirds of all public spending are at the federal level, one-third at the state and local level. I think Europe could do with the reverse, two-thirds at the state and local and one-third. But the current number is clearly not viable as a way of running. Where it becomes particularly important is when you have shocks. California, say, had a high unemployment rate, but it doesn't have to pay for the unemployment insurance. It's paid federally. So those are so when you have it, but in Europe, you have the countries that are affected negatively by a shock have to pay for it, for that themselves. So there's not enough, you might call cross support. I've argued that what Europe needs is just like they had a solidarity fund for the new entrants. There needs to be a solidarity fund for stabilization to recognize, and it's not, Germany's position that we are not a transfer union is a statement that we are not a union. You cannot have a union without some degree of solidarity of at least this kind of support when you're having a negative shock. Finally, I think you need a banking union. And a banking union that's not just common supervision, but also common deposit insurance and common resolution. They've agreed on that as a matter of principle, but the speed is so slow. I describe how money is leaving these countries, and that's leading to credit being constrained, and which is exacerbating the divergence. So they created a system based on that would promote divergence rather than convergence. One more aspect related to the issue of inequality that I've talked about. One of the problems is that if you are a young Irish person, and you are now faced with paying off your parents' debts that were foisted on you by, say, the ECB. There's an easy way you can avoid paying your debts. You just move. So you move to London, you move to, So they created a system where you have responsibility, but you can escape responsibility by having a single market where you can move freely. That's not a coherent system. And with a major social problem in society is inequality, I think. If any country decides to raise taxes, people will just leave. That was the first question about the inheritance tax. One of the problems is that in any individual country tries to raise their inheritance taxes, rich people will just move to some other country with a lower inheritance tax. And I know people have done this. So the point is that unless Europe has a framework which can have progressive taxation at the European level, it's going to be very hard to attack the problem of inequality.
Okay, I'm afraid we are running out of time here, and there are many more hands than there are minutes left. So I'm going to take three quick questions, if you can remember them, Joe, and then we'll have to end. The gentleman in the pink shirt, the gentleman behind him, and Julian, who runs our ethics and science group.
Thanks for a great lecture. Could you comment a bit about how you see the state of economics as an academic discipline in being able to respond to these challenges over the long term? I mean, there's a course in Manchester, a sort of post-crash economics course, which recently was called
behind you.
I just wonder if you could comment a little bit about the austerity, which has been very much the championed by our politicians as one of the reasons why the economy has improved a bit in this country. And then with what you said about being rather introspective about our own economies, what the knock-on effects will be in the developing world if we continue to do that over the next several years for the reduction in investment there, which obviously may be a risk for us in the future.
And
So each year the US Department of Education conducts a national adult literacy survey, which is essentially an IQ test. And it's repeatedly said that the people in the bottom 50% lack the cognitive ability to enjoy the rights and fulfill the responsibilities of citizenship. So you need an IQ of 95 to complete a tax return in the US. So the obvious solution to this is better education and training, we've heard today. But given that most studies show that 50% of IQ is due to environmental influences and 50% is actually due to biological differences, how hopeful are you that we are up to these kinds of challenges that we've created for ourselves in a very complex and different world to that which was the case in the Second World War?
Julian looks at the ethics of enhancement.
I could have asked you whether we're morally fit, but I think the cognitive one is easier.
Great. Well, that's more than enough to chew on in the 3 minutes that.
Okay. Let me take them in reverse order. One of the focal points of a lot of discussions in the United States has been on preschool education, because what we recognize is that by the time kids get to kindergarten, first grade, there are huge differences in cognitive abilities, but that there's very strong evidence that preschool can reduce significantly those differences. So, and it's not that expensive, but one of the most interesting elections was the mayor of New York, the mayoral election in New York, who ran on a campaign saying that he was going to raise taxes on the top to finance a preschool education program, and citing work of Jim Heckman on the evidence that preschool education is very, very effective. A little bit of an answer to the first question of some of the things that are going on and having some effect. I do want to point out there's also some interesting research that has pointed out that poor families, children, babies are exposed to a lot of risk prenatal, that the environmental hazards that they face where they live are significant, and that those have turn up to have lifelong effects. And so that there's an increasing amount of research showing that some of these things are a result of our physical environment and the adverse. And then finally, food and health, access to food and access to health. It's still the case in America, even though 1 out of 7 Americans are on food stamps, about 1 out of 7 Americans goes to bed
hungry on a regular basis, not because they're on a diet, because they can't afford it. And so, you know, I was in India, and these statistics came out a couple of years ago, first time they came out, a couple of people came up, and they put it on the, you know, front page, because, you know, hunger, everybody knows about hunger in India. They said, how can the richest country in the world have 1 out of 7 people hungry? And I said, well, we've managed to create a system with a high level of inequality. And that's, you know, what happens. I feel very strongly that austerity, both theory and evidence, is austerity has been really bad. There's always the question of the counterfactual. Where would you have been today if you had not done austerity? You know, and I believe very strongly that you would have had a much less deep downturn, and you'd be in a much better position today. At the beginning of the austerity period, there were a couple papers that were widely cited by a couple professors at Harvard about this notion of expansionary contractions. And if it sounds like an oxymoron, it is. It was really, I mean, real example of shoddy academic research that was totally ideologically driven. And then a very nice paper came out, out of a think tank, out of Roosevelt Institute, pointing out case by case what was wrong. You know, and the basic argument is, if government contracts and you are lucky enough to have a situation where your trading partner is expanding, the exports can come in when the government goes down. And if you have a flexible, especially if you have a flexible exchange rate, you're a small economy, the negative effects don't appear. But if those lucky circumstances aren't there, it's a disaster. And this was one of those cases where a paper written by a think tank got picked up by the IMF, and they very they came out and said this notion of expansionary contraction is nonsense, and provided very strong support to very strong support against austerity under kind of circumstances. This also speaks a little bit to the question about the economics profession. A lot of research gets reported about multipliers, you know, government spending, how much, if the government spending goes up, how much does GDP go up? And there was, in the economics profession, a widespread belief that the multiplier was zero. And that was because the economics profession as a whole was very conservative. In the Great Depression, the majority of the members of the American Economic Association signed a petition saying the government shouldn't do anything. And you know, you say, well, aren't these serious academics? How could they get a result that the multiplier is zero? You know, and they cited studies after studies that are published in good journals. Easy answer. What happened was, you do a study when the economy is at full employment. When the economy is at full employment, you increase government spending. By definition, when the economy is at full employment, you're not going to get output to increase. You may actually get some, it may even decrease because it creates some distortions, people have to adjust. But the bottom line is, you shouldn't expect, nobody talked about a multiplier when the government was already, when the economy was already at full employment. What they meant when they said a multiplier is, when we're way below full employment, like we were in 2009, what is the multiplier? And the bulk of the research in economics had nothing to say about that, because they had focused on situations where we were near full employment. Well, let me get just on the question of the developing country. We live in a world of globalization. What happens in one part of the global economy affects others. But countries can take actions to try to minimize, mitigate those adverse effects. So when the North Atlantic crisis began, China saw demand for exports plummeting, and
It was sitting on $3 trillion of reserves. It felt confident that it could offset that. And so the best student of Keynesian economics was China. And it worked. Now, there's a lot of debate. Did it exacerbate some long-term structural problems? I don't, you know, want to go into that. But in terms of the short-term offsetting, the short-term negative effects of the plummeting trade, it succeeded. In fact, they went through a period of very, very high economic growth. What we do have to be aware of is that there are macroeconomic externalities that are very significant, and what we do does affect others. And that was, of course, especially true in the context of the financial sector, where problems in one part move very strongly across to others. And that goes back to some of the what's wrong with the neoliberal ideology that prevailed at the time of the euro. They didn't recognize the notion of externalities at all. Cross-border externalities, externalities from the financial sector to the real sector. Their belief was that markets on their own are stable and efficient. No recognition of corporate governance problems, principal agent problems. If they exist, markets solve them efficiently. But in fact, we know that corporate governance problems are very severe, and that the incentive structures of the banks were focused on short-term excessive risk-taking. They were incentive structures that were designed, not intentionally, but they had if the financial sector had not behaved as badly as it did, we would have had to rewrite our textbooks because it would be a sign that people weren't acting rationally consistent with our models. So to me, when Alan Greenspan said that he was surprised that the private sector, the market, the banks didn't manage the risk better, in a congressional testimony and what was called the flaw, his reasoning, I was surprised that he was surprised. And if he had looked at the incentive structures, if he looked at what the banks were doing, how they were behaving, it's exactly what a number of people said was going on and anticipated. It was just that he had these blinders. And those were the same blinders that were there at the time of the construction of the Eurozone and have not really come down to the extent that they should. So the final question, where is the economics profession? What I said in the beginning was that actually a lot of the pieces of the economics that actually would describe the economy were there before the crisis. We had good models of banks. I don't want to say they're the perfect models. We had good models of bank. None of those were in the DSJ models. We had behavioral economics had developed and was flourishing and interesting insights. Very different views about determinants of savings than maximizing an intertemporal utility function. Totally different macroeconomic behavior than would be predicted by those models, which are still the dominant models. We had, if you look across the span of areas, there were even, talk about network analysis. Everybody talks about how the failure of one banking system led to another. I wrote a book in 2003 with my colleague Bruce Greenwald called A New Paradigm for Monetary Economics, where we modeled those kind of bankruptcy cascades. One of my former students, Franklin Allen, who's a student here at Oxford, has done really nice work on analyzing these bankruptcy interactions. We had done work beginning, limited data were available looking at bank networks, but we had already done that before the crisis and recognized some of the network interactions. But none of this was part of the mainstream. The good news is now that it's becoming, that there is a shift. We had a meeting at the IMF in December with the INEP, one of the groups at the Martin School. We had a meeting at INEP at the IMF on macroeconomic externalities. We had a meeting about 3 weeks ago on network analysis and financial stability. So these ideas are beginning to change, but to me, it is remarkable how in certain parts of the economic profession, I would say large parts, they somehow have taken an antidote and are a vaccine against these changes. And so it's news to them that the 2008 crisis, for them, that was just an accident. And what they say is, you know, these things happen only once in 100 years, 80 years, and if our models work most of the time, so what? If we don't understand why people die, as long as we can cure their colds. And that's, to me, what the analogous kind of view. And so it is still a battle that is going on, and particularly in macroeconomics, where there are still people, colleagues who say, what is the fuss about unemployment? They're just enjoying more leisure. And when I say, usually people, when they're enjoying more leisure, they're happy. And these people seem very unhappy, and they have some of the correlate symptoms of unhappiness, like divorce, suicide. They say, that's a problem for psychiatry, not for economics.
The good news, I think, is that Joe's been made the president of the International Economics Association, which does provide, I think, a ray of light that the profession might be changing to have made you the president, and I know you're going to have one. Also, in the Oxford Martin School, we have a new curriculum development program, which Wendy Carlin is developing. And so there's a big effort to try and rewrite the economics curriculum to create a much more pluralistic one, which will, of course, include a lot of Joe's work. I'm sorry that you haven't all had time to ask your questions. There's a huge amount in his books that might respond to some of them. Joe's been great about coming back to Oxford regularly. This isn't the first lecture he's given for us, and I really hope that you come back soon again. I know we've got work to do this afternoon, and we'll be carrying on with. I encourage you also, if you don't know the Oxford Martin School, to look at our website. We have some forthcoming events which might be of interest. Liam Byrne, who's the Shadow Minister for Universities, Science and Skills, will be talking about the Labour Party's agenda for education and inclusive growth on the 5th of June at 5 o'clock here. On the 11th of June, we have Professor Kosolsky, who will talk on migration policy. And then our seminar series for this term, which is on citizen science, continues on Thursdays at 3:30, next Thursday, 29th, on the 12th of June. So do keep an eye on the website. There's plenty happening, not least in the Institute for New Economic Thinking, on the themes that that Joe's been exploring. I'm sure, like me, you are in awe of Joe's ability to cover a vast range. Our demand is always in excess of the supply of time, I'm afraid, and of you. But thank you, Joe, for coming, and thanks to all of you for participating.